Welcome to Media Shift number 185, your guide to the digital media revolution. I'm Mark Glazer. This week, we'll be talking about how Twitter is reversing its chronology, how Yahoo's prospects are dimmer than the New York Times, and the new gambit by Wired Magazine to take on ad blockers. Plus, I'll talk more in depth about the ad blocking menace and what publishers should really do in my rant and rave segment. And I'll talk one-on-one with Monica Guzman about real engagement and her Nieman Fellowship. Media Shift, in association with Acquia, is producing a free online panel, How to Personalize Your Content for Better Engagement, with top online publishers describing their winning strategies. I'll be moderating the session on Big Marker with panelists Sam Hahn of The Washington Post and Dave Ingram of Acquia. The panel will take place on March 2nd at 1 p.m. Eastern, 10 a.m. Pacific. Join us online and register at bit.ly/pcontent. That's bit.ly/pcontent. Now the big news of the week. Twitter reverses the chronology. For about 10 years, we've expected to see posts on Twitter come up with the freshest latest at the top, the typical reverse chronological order. But Facebook has been doing something different, putting the posts up top that it thinks are most important for us based on the number of likes, implied interests, and more. And now Twitter is edging toward doing the same thing, leading to an uproar among users who've used the hashtag RIP Twitter. At the same time, Twitter's launching a new video ad slot called First View that would come up first in your timeline. And all this is about creating a better experience for new as well as loyal users. And Twitter's saying, you have the option to turn it off, but we all know where this is heading. It will be on by default, all the better to serve advertisers and new users who don't want to scroll through a ton of irrelevant tweets. As Twitter's growth has stalled, even losing 2 million users in the recent quarter, it will need all the tweaks it can get to expand its user base and keep its business model on track. Yahoo and the New York Times shuffle the deck. If you think it's hard changing course in the digital era, if you're an old line brand like the New York Times, what about the first wave of digital companies like AOL and Yahoo? They have an even more difficult time changing course because expectations are so much higher and tastes are ever-changing online. We saw this so clearly in recent announcements from the New York Times and Yahoo. The Times announced 20% growth in digital subscriptions for 2015 versus the previous year, and profits were up nearly 50% in the quarter. And digital ad revenues were up, while print revenues were down. But help is on the horizon with T Studios creating native ad content. The Times is also considering reorganizing its newsroom away from its classic desks, the International Desk, the Metro Desk, the Breaking News Desk, and others, so it can move faster. Meanwhile, Yahoo announced that it earned 13 cents per share recently, but that was excluding a massive write-down for failed acquisitions worth $4.4 billion. The company will be closing down 5 global offices, is basically putting itself up for sale as it lays off 15% of its workforce and closes its digital magazine experiments. While Yahoo and AOL lost their way trying to bulk up on content and now need to retrench as ad companies, old stalwarts like The Times and others are finding their way and trying to stay true to very old roots as media brands. You call it the revenge of old media. Wired to ad blockers, turn them off or pay up. It's a running battle between news publishers and readers. Publishers need to serve more and more ads and trackers, and readers are getting fed up with them and turning on ad blockers. But some publishers have been pushing back. The latest is Wired Magazine, which announced that it's giving visitors with ad blocking software 3 choices. 1, turn off the ad blocker and experience their wonderful ads. Or 2, pay $1 a week for an ad-free experience. or three, go away. They say that 20% of their visitors have ad blockers on, and that's hurting their bottom line. Fair enough, but blocking visitors to a site could have worse consequences for publishers that decide to go that route. It could curtail growth and block curious visitors. Wired editors note that they were the ones who started it all off back in the day with the first banner ads on Hotwired back in 1994, which is back when I wrote movie reviews for them. They say they're going to continue to experiment to find new ways to bring you the stories you love while also supporting their business model. Okay, but we'll see how people react, whether they really pay up and turn off the ad blockers or take their attention elsewhere. More on ad blocking coming up after the break during my rant and rave segment. Now it's time to rant and rave. You might be surprised, or not, that I'm going to rant against news publishers and rave about ad blockers. If you're in the news business, the latest scapegoat for the supposed death of journalism, which isn't anywhere near dead, is ad blockers. This is software that basically eliminates most banner ads in your experience online. And while the big hoo-ha lately has been about Apple allowing ad blockers on iPhones, ad blockers have been around for years. And it's pretty obvious why ad blockers have become so popular lately. If you will go online to read news stories from newspapers, magazines, broadcasters, just about every news site, and a lot of apps, you're inundated with all manner of advertising. You've got pop-ups, interstitials, animations, skyscrapers, videos with audio, silent videos, and on and on. And even when you're reading news on your mobile phone, there's a good chance that you get the same stuff bombarding you. It'd be one thing if these ads were of some value to you, so-called desired ads, that were selling you just what you were looking for. But let's face it, even with all the data that advertisers have on you, they rarely target the right ad at the right time. We've all been followed around by car ads after spending 2 minutes looking at cars on a couple websites. And even after you bought the car, you still see those ads popping up all over. Of course, people are going to use ad blockers. It's just an extension of all the other ways we try to eliminate advertising from our lives. VCRs, later DVRs, just to skip the ads. Get Netflix, which has no ads, a real poke in the eye of the advertising overload complex. Even Hulu, which forces us to watch ads during programs, is experimenting with just one interactive ad at the start of programs. So what are news publishers doing in reaction to the rise of even more ad blocking? Well, they're attacking the ad blocking companies and attacking the users. Let's block everyone who's using ad blockers. Death to the ad blockers. They're a threat to news and information. They're a threat to journalism. They're a threat to our business and a threat to democracy. No, not really. There are real solutions beyond blaming everyone but yourself for the ad experience that you created, publishers. I'm not a huge fan of this, but what Wired recently did with charging people with ad blockers $1 a week for an ad-free experience is something. At least there's some kind of engagement beyond just the bluster. And there's an obvious parallel to this with other digital services. Pandora and Spotify, and now YouTube, will play ads between songs and videos for the free service, or you can pay a monthly fee for an ad-free experience. Will that translate over to news and content? I'm not sure, but micropayment service Blendle is a promising idea. Now, people can pay a couple cents per story for an ad-free experience, and Blendle did pretty well in Holland and Germany, and it's coming to the United States pretty soon. Or there's the native ad experience, where brands pay for sponsored content that lives within the editorial well, sometimes not very well demarcated from regular content. But these generally work better than the flashing, whooshing, annoying ads. The catch is that native ads need to be valuable content in their own right for people to read them, share them, and in some way give a nod to advertisers. In the end, it's up to publishers and advertisers to take the user experience seriously, to take ad content seriously. If you give us ads that we really want, something relevant, something entertaining, something thoughtful, smart, thought-provoking, we'll accept that. We'll want that. We might even turn off the ad blocker. Joining me on the podcast this week is a familiar voice for our audience, Monica Guzman, who used to be a regular on the old roundtable version of our podcast. Guzman is a technology and media columnist for GeekWire, The Daily Beast, and Columbia Journalism Review. She's vice chair of the Society of Professional Journalists Ethics Committee and contributed to the Poynter book, The New Ethics of Journalism. Guzman was an online reporter for the Seattle Post-Intelligencer and for the all-digital SeattlePI.com before working for 2 years with tech startups. She's also a pioneer of community and social engagement with readers and is currently a Nieman Fellow at Harvard and is examining how journalists can reconsider their roles to meet the demands of online public discourse.
Thank you. Yeah, it's good to be here.
So what's it like being a fellow at Harvard and living in Boston now?
Oh, man, it's been amazing. This is a year where you can take a break from your daily work, whatever that happened to be, and do some scholarship, do some reflection, and do a different kind of work to, you know, fortify or deepen whatever skills you feel you need to do that with. So for me, some of this I predicted, you know, some of this I could actually anticipate and plan for what I would want to be exploring while I was here at Harvard. And other things have been surprising, but I've taken courses at the Harvard Business School that have changed the way I think about the industry's struggles. I have taken some theory on leadership, especially in times of change and organizational culture. But the main thing I came to do and that I've been getting really deep into is the nature of conversation, public discussion, how people come together, share stories, and how that can be a productive thing for everybody. How can this age of expression be as good as it can possibly be for the diversity and the quality of the news conversation?
Yeah. And when it comes to online conversation, I think now all we think about is trolling. You know, it seems like the extremes, like in all discourse, really in the US at least, that seems like one of the bigger challenges when it comes to online discourse.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not even just the reality of the challenge. It's also the perceived challenges, because I think precisely that culture of extremes is part of what makes a lot of journalists hesitate. They're not sure they want to engage. You know, what does that even mean? Does that mean I put myself at risk? Do I expose myself too much? Might I even put my own credibility to do this work at risk if I'm talking to the public? But that means that you're multiplying the occasions where you could screw up, you know, and that's scary to a lot of people. It's scary to me. I'm very encouraged by civility. I think it's attainable. I think it's doable. I think one of the main ingredients in getting civility in online discourse is somebody paying attention and listening. And I think that somebody can be a journalist. And I think that it's more fruitful than many people think. It is time consuming, but it's very rewarding too.
Yeah. What about the Coral Project? I know this is something that people are trying. They're trying to come up with a new type of commenting system. You know, I've heard about it, but I haven't really seen what's come out of it. Is there something about that?
There's all kinds of really interesting projects going on right now. A tool I just learned about the other day from the MIT Media Lab and a fellow student in a class there called Civil. What it is it's a commenting system where each commenter, in order to be allowed to leave a comment, has to rate the civility of a previous comment and then rate the civility of their own. You know, if we get people to rate civility, they'll be more mindful of it. We can compare different ratings, and they've got a whole system built around it. So I'm optimistic that technology can really assist. And I know the Coral Project is kind of going off some of the same assumptions, that you can codify good cultivation of a civil conversation into a tool. And I think that's true. Although I think I will always suspect any idea that technology alone can do that. I mean, conversations are conversations, right, and they require people. And moderation, I think, is a skill that is not well understood, but is very powerful.
Yeah. As with all of these kinds of solutions, it always seems like if you just leave it to the technology, there's going to be people will figure out ways around it, and there's bound to be failures in the system without people actually, humans actually being involved in some way.
Right.
People are talking aloud about engagement and how you know, journalists and editors and everyone needs to be more engaged. I mean, some people will say, well, yeah, we had this post on Facebook and it had 38 likes and, you know, this tweet had 84 retweets and, you know, we're really, you know, killing it with engagement. It's like, really? Really? I don't know. That's just, what did that really mean? Like, how do you, like, what is meaningful engagement? I mean, that, maybe that's something that every organization has to define themselves, but I feel like there's this kind of, there's fake engagement and real engagement.
Exactly. Engagement has become a stand-in for more limited things than I think the spirit of engagement is trying to get at. So, you know, marketing, promotion, that is, you know, that can be a very positive consequence of good engagement, but it's just a piece of it. But it, I think if you take a step back and you look at what the industry needs and what the public is making possible, engagement is not limited to marketing or promotion or crowdsourcing, but it's more broadly making sure your work matters. And it is cultivating public and financial support via closer connections and interactions with the audience. This is somewhat semantic, but I have a problem with the term the audience. We don't have a better term, and I recognize that. But basically, kind of makes the public people in a transaction based solely on whether they consume your content. So it's defining them in your terms, and I think that that's sort of unfortunate. So I'll pause to say that I feel like we need maybe a new, fresher language, something that accepts the fact that people are out there with their stories and it's their stories. We, the journalists, should be very grateful. So I prefer to look at it as this is sort of having the privilege to tap into the wealth of knowledge that and truth that exists just in people. And that's what engagement is to me. And I think when you do it right, you can build an enormous amount of public support for your work. And that's both as an individual and as an organization. And you can also build an enormous amount of financial sustainability through these kinds of mechanisms and these ways of approaching the work.
Yeah, I mean, it really is. I mean, first of all, they are people. They're not users. They're human right. beings. And I think that's hard when you're running a business to think about them that way, especially when you're a publisher, you're a news organization, and you think about your customers as the advertisers or something else.
Exactly.
And you kind of lose sight of the fact that, you know, even the numbers that we use when it comes to metrics, when it's, you know, 10 million unique users, whatever you, however you measure that, you know, that to me is just a big mass, you know, it's a big ball of nothing, you know, and whenever you get down to who they are, it ends up just being a demographic for advertising. So,
yeah,
you know, really understanding the people out there, who these people are and what they want, that seems like the first good step.
Quite naturally, a lot of the ways that we approach this, we borrow from marketing. I think that there's something that flows out of the service of journalism that demands more of journalists, or at least can make a lot more possible and even calls journalists to do a certain kind of leadership. We're very unfamiliar with that role, and I'm still exploring it. I'm wondering what it would look like, but I think there's a really amazing potential for that too.
Part of the Nieman Fellowship is around leadership. And I know the Knight Fellowships at Stanford, they also have kind of a leadership component. Is this about you learning what it takes to be a leader? Is it more about how do we train leaders? How do we retrain leaders? Because the leaders seem like the ones who are mostly in the way when it comes to media companies to me.
So I subscribe to this notion, and there's a professor at the Harvard Kennedy School, Ron Heifetz, who's very well known for putting forth this idea of what leadership is. But he argues and makes a very good case that leadership and authority are not the same thing. So that there actually is no such thing as a leadership position. Authority is no guarantee of leadership. The problems and the struggles that journalists are faced with are all problems and struggles that are new and require new solutions. We don't already know how to solve these problems. In those cases, the people in authority don't necessarily have any more specialized knowledge about what those answers are than anybody else. So you're faced with this dilemma. Leadership is mobilizing people to do the work to solve tough problems they all share. So in my mind, everyone in a newsroom owns a piece of these problems. And so ideally, you'd want everyone in the newsroom to be mobilized to work on those problems. But I think what you end up seeing you know, the reporters or the staff are looking to their authority figures, expecting them to have the answers and to offer salvation. Right. Meanwhile, the authority figures don't actually have the answers, but feel pressured to kind of pretend that they do. And the only way to get them is to get experimental. That requires having a very high failure rate. And the culture of most newsrooms cannot tolerate a high failure rate. Newsrooms are just especially stubborn places to try to flex out so that they can be more nimble. So I think a lot about that when I think about leadership and the lessons I'm learning here at Neiman and through different, you know, companies and different theories, and you kind of apply it to journalism and you see that there's, it's like everyone's guilty and no one's guilty. This is a really, really tricky situation to try to get out of.
Yeah. And it's such a command and control structure. Yes. In these kinds of organizations. And like you said, you look to the authority figures, you look to the top, when in this case, you really, having a more decentralized organization makes more sense, where you can have innovation from the edges and innovation from people at the bottom up. You know, if you know, an organization can be built in that way, and maybe some of these newer organizations are doing that, the ones without kind of the legacy setup. But, you know, yeah. People in power, even in those newer organizations, still, you know, come out of a history within the older organization. So it's a cultural thing that's very hard to change.
Absolutely. And it doesn't, nobody's evil in any of this. Everyone's trying really hard. Part of the problem is that these systems, you know, the architectures in newsrooms are really strong. And we yeah. like to believe that, you know, the right person can come along and just bust through those structures, but that's really not the case.
Well, let's switch gears a little bit and talk about the elections that have been happening in the U.S. for the presidential race and just how the media is covering it. It's been a really big campaign, you know, when it comes to social media. I mean, for whatever reason, you know, Trump live tweeting Democratic debates and just, it's been very weird in a lot of ways too. And I mean, the small donations that Bernie Sanders is raising. What have you seen so far?
Somebody the other day told me about Ted Cruz. He has an app called, what is it? The Cruz Crew, I believe.
Uh-huh.
And I haven't looked at it myself, but I hear that it's amazingly addictive. And that it kind of gamifies supporting Cruz. So there's all these points you can earn, you know, and you can go, if you knock on doors, you earn this many points. And if you share this on Twitter, you earn this many points. And it's apparently a pretty big deal. And it's helping his campaign quite a lot. And he's got a lot of grassroots going on there. So that's pretty fascinating. And then on the other side is our favorite Donald Trump. It's amazing to me how, I think he's the first candidate that really doesn't need the media, right? Because Twitter's his channel. What else does he need? And he's so media savvy. I mean, he's been around. He knows how this works. You know, when people can be their own media, when government right. agencies can be their own media, when anybody can be their own media, then what's the media for?
Talk about just turning all the conventional wisdom on its head. I mean, it's really, there's definitely something going on that's very strange. And I mean, I was at a kind of a new media conference. And there was like a breakout session where people, you know, who are journalists, kind of new media type people, and they were literally saying like, okay, now what are we going to do to stop Trump? Well, first of all, I don't think that's the role of the media in the first place, you know, yeah. but also, yeah, it's just, I don't know that you're going to do anything. Yeah. You know, I don't think the yeah. media is losing, like you said, it's losing its role.
Yeah. And to tie in a little bit of what we were talking before, the, you know, this idea that maybe journalists can help be leaders, in that we can lead the public toward more productive, diverse, better conversations about the news with each other. Mm-hmm. I think yeah. that's a really critical issue when it comes to the campaign, because, you know, are we providing context? Where are we doing that in a good way? You know, when are we yeah. keeping people accountable, making sure people are informed? And one example of this is, when I think critically about campaign coverage in this election, I think a lot about Donald Trump, as everyone does. And it's happening. You know, there's this incentive to just write about Trump, write about Trump, write about Trump. It doesn't even matter what you say. To me, Donald Trump and his popularity is not about Donald Trump. It's about his supporters. It's about people who are compelled by the message. That is the most interesting thing about Donald Trump. Yeah. But I see no coverage, like none, of just, let's go up and talk to people and understand, what is the mix of experiences and disenchantments with the government? Whatever it is, let's talk to them. And it's only when you can get those perspectives talking to each other, I think, that we can advance any understanding of what's going on. favorite story, this is the last thing I'll say, but my favorite story that I've seen in this campaign so far, I believe it was in The Guardian. It was an account of a Muslim woman who went to a Donald Trump rally. And she went to the Donald Trump rally not to protest, but just to meet people and talk to them. And it was a fascinating and beautiful story. And she actually gets in a little more in depth, you know, talking to people and trying to understand how they feel, what they feel, and being very generous and really listening. That's exactly what I'd like to see more people doing. That story was by far the most productive thing I think I've read about Donald Trump.
Do you have a dream job within media or even outside of media that you'd like to have one day?
I'm working on a couple of different ideas that would all be dreams in one way or another. But I think my mission,
You're going to be an engagement editor.
Yeah, I mean, maybe. Like, how can journalists be a bigger part of making better conversations that lead to a better society? You know, how can we understand the mechanisms at play and, you know, make it more of a service, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know that that necessarily means, all right, you know, I'm up for being an engagement editor in a newsroom. I'm actually fairly skeptical about cultures in newsrooms, and I need to be cautious. So I'm also thinking, maybe I just need to go out and start something, you know. Coral Project, Civil, maybe there's a tool, maybe there's a team I can work with, I don't know. But I know that I need to do more to make an impact in that particular thing. I'm ready to go back into working with a team and to committing to that. And you know some of my history. I was with the Seattle Post-Intelligencer when it closed, and that was a very traumatic experience. It made me scared to commit because it was so painful. But I'm realizing there's no other way. You know, you've got to get to where things are dangerous. In an industry like this, if you're going to make an impact.
Well, anyway, thanks for joining us. I appreciate it. And good luck on your journey. I hope I'm sure it'll take some really great turns. Thanks for listening to the MediaShift podcast. Thanks to our special guest, Monica Guzman, and our producer, Jefferson Yen. Check out the latest news and features at mediashift.org and follow us at MediaShiftPod on Twitter. If you have a thought or comment on anything we said on the show, ad blocking or engagement or anything, be sure to send us a note at MediaShiftPod on Twitter. Our past episodes are on SoundCloud, and if you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on iTunes and leave us a review. We'll catch you next week.